Welcome to Equipped, a podcast by Connection Church. Today we're going to be talking about the book of Exodus, and we've got a lot to say about feet. Let's get equipped. Today, I am joined by Quentin Thurman, Russ DeMott, and Jessica Navarro. We have a lot to say about the book of Exodus. I'm Jordan Thigpen, and I'm excited for us to begin talking through, as we intro, the book of Exodus. And for all the folks in our Connect groups that are going through the 412 reading plan, we wanted to give some type of a companion conversation for the book of Exodus as we walk through this. I'd say a lot of people, I think, in our church or in general, I think Exodus is a book that people, it's not one of the ones and not one of the books of the Bible that people tend to avoid, I guess you would say. It seems like a book that people are, you know, there's a lot of common Sunday school stories from the book of Exodus, right? We've got the burning bush, we've got the giving of the Ten Commandments, you got the crossing of the Red Sea. You've got lots of stories like that are very common throughout the overall story of Moses. But there's some really powerful theological stuff within the book of Exodus, but also some verses and some passages that we need to take time to talk through. But how are you guys doing? Everybody had a good weekend, good week, getting off to a good start?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Old Russ preached his first message yesterday on a Sunday morning.
Let's go.
Man, saw a few people got saved.
Yeah, half the family had five salvations.
My gosh.
It was just Q and I were talking. Q probably saw me at my lowest point right after the 11 o'clock. I think just the awe of what God had done in the messages began to overwhelm me, and I kind of went backstage and fell apart for a few minutes.
My favorite Russ. Russ fought just the wheels completely off is my favorite Russ.
It's funny, yeah. You say like at your worst, I'm like, I was so proud of you, you know, in that moment, you know. And I think it's always hard. Like, I never know what to say to anybody that preaches because I don't want to say like, oh, you did such a great job, because it's not them that was doing it. But I was like, I was both shocked and also like, yeah, like, this is exactly what I expected from Russ.
Yeah.
Just like, I was, you know, like, I think the Spirit of God moved through you, and I mean, we should be overwhelmed when that happens.
Yeah.
That shouldn't be something that we ever like grow tired of feeling that like, wow, God just used me in such an amazing way.
That's right. Yeah. I went home and spent some time. I actually got in the tub and was just thinking, and Q texted me and said, how are you feeling or something to that extent? And I was like, man, it's just incredible that God would see fit to use a bum like myself for his glory and to, you know, speak through me to see five people that now are no longer bound by their sin and have been into, you know, brought into the kingdom of heaven. So that's incredible.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I'm trying to not make fun of you for getting in the tub.
Yeah.
Hey. You make fun of me all you want to. That tub's miraculous.
That might be the thing that heals your back. Maybe you need to get in the tub.
Maybe you need to get in the tub.
I'm too poor to have an actual tub. We just have like that shower insert.
Oh, so yeah. That'll work the same.
It wouldn't reach my upper back.
You just got to lay down a little farther. Put your legs up, you know, and just lay down a little farther.
Even as I think about
we don't need to get graphic.
That would...
When I post these on Spotify, I say there's no explicit content. Okay, I don't want to have to switch it to yes.
Yeah, let's just say I don't want to do that.
All right.
Plus, like, you know, on the tub, leaning with your head like way pushed forward, you know, like you'd have to do that.
We are imagining way different, like, positions, but that's okay.
Interesting.
Sounds like the building's falling down.
No, yeah, it's just that utility door behind my office is just a bundle of racket, and it always is. Jess, how's the DR training going for the college students?
You know, it's great. We are getting closer and closer to time, so it's good.
Anytime, like, you know, Morgan consistently has this experience. I had this experience when I was doing a lot more of the short-term mission trip stuff. It's like, No one's signing up. Oh my gosh, we got way too many people. And then no one's giving any money. No one's raising any money. No one's going to finish their funding. No one's going to finish their training. And voila.
The Lord provides.
The Lord provides.
Absolutely.
So, well, cool. Q, anything going on? Cool. I mean, Charlotte's little personality is just popping out all over the place. A lot of fun baby noises in the hallway.
Still not sleeping.
Right. I come to work and she's here. I go home and she's here. And so, what more can you really ask for?
Amen.
There's no sarcasm in my voice. But, no, I mean, God's been moving in crazy ways through baptisms. And so that's been taking up a lot of my time lately, which is an awesome thing. And heart and soul and all the good things.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, for sure.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think I hear pretty consistently from people in the life of our church, both on staff and our elders, but also like in the church from just our congregation of people that are seeing more and more how important like and how like really good our like salvation, baptism, and heart and soul processes are, and specifically giving encouragement about your role in that and your job. So you're doing a great job with that, man. It's really cool.
Well, I really appreciate that.
For sure.
Yep. So heart and soul and having a newborn. It sounds like the burning bushes in your life right now.
Dude, it's going off.
Yeah.
Now I just need to stop acting like Moses and
yeah,
take my shoes off, you know, and get ready.
Well, we might as well just jump into the book of Exodus on that point. We're going to talk about in this episode. I know, Quentin, you were thinking 1 through 10 because this, you know, Exodus is 40 chapters, and so it'd be nice and neat to break it up, you know, 1 through 10 and then 11 through 20 and yada, yada, yada. But I think it's a better ending if we stop after chapter 11 for this one. So that'll get us through what I'll kind of break down is three kind of primary movements in Exodus. From chapters 1 through 11. And I think what we'll do is, team, as we kind of look at this passage, if there are specific things that stand out or well, let's start here. When you look, so what we have, let me give sort of a 30,000 foot outline. And then I'm purely asking, again, because this is for our Connect Group leaders, people that are actively making disciples. From your own devotional life, stop staring at your Bibles for just a second. From your own devotional lives, things that have stood out to you over your time of walking with the Lord in Exodus chapters 1 through 11, roughly. Or it can be just general themes, things that have stood out to you from the book of Exodus. But then we'll go through and we'll try to untangle any sort of textual knots that we see in these verses, in these chapters that to best prepare our Connect Group leaders for group. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So what I see in Exodus, so just for our Connect Group leaders and for us, right, this is coming right off of the heels of Genesis. So Exodus is meant to be read in complement with the books of Genesis, and then you got Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, right? So those are referred to as the books of Moses. Those are the first five books that that are typically referred to as, our Jewish friends refer to it as the Torah. A lot of times for us as Protestant evangelicals, we refer to it as the Pentateuch or just the books of Moses. They're the ones that we look at and say Moses wrote most of the, probably penned most of the content of these books. And so Exodus is for sure picking up on the events after the death of Joseph in Genesis chapter 50. Mm-hmm. It's picking up on that of the 12 tribes of what was Israel. Israel was Jacob, who's the son of Isaac. Jacob goes on to have his name. He has this experience with God, and God changes his name to Israel, and then he has 12 sons. One of those is Joseph. That's the coat of many colors guy, if you're wondering. He goes down to Egypt and he rises to prominence. This is still the end of Genesis. But he was sent, what Joseph looks back on his life and says, what you meant for evil, which is his brother sold him into slavery, what you meant for evil, God used for good. And so that's how we kind of close out the book of Genesis, is that there's these people that God is forming as descendants of Abraham into his own people. And that's through the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, Exodus chapter 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel. So that's where we pick up in Exodus. Who came to Egypt with Jacob. Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. Each came with his family. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin. Dan and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And so those are the 12, what become the 12 tribes of Israel. Moses is going to arrange them by tribe in the Exodus that will happen much later in the book. For now, what we know is that these families, what Exodus chapter 1 begins with, is all you need to know from this is that those families have a bunch of kids. And they have so many kids and become such a giant family that it becomes concerning to the leadership of Egypt. So chapter 1, I would say, is the decline in conditions for Israel. So Israel beginning to be sort of a summary statement of all the people, all the descendants of this guy named Israel. And so there's a decline in their conditions. It says Pharaoh and his workers make life hard for them. Chapters 2 through 6 establish Moses as the deliverer of God's people, or these 12 tribes that are gathered in Egypt. And chapters 2 through 6 are just establishing Moses is going to be the guy that God uses to deliver them. And chapters 7 through 11 are these collection of plague stories. So this is what God promises, that he will use Moses. He will send these plagues to cause Pharaoh to release his grasp, metaphorically, and I guess literally, to let God's people go, to come out from Egypt. And so what thoughts do y'all have kind of on the surface, thinking about the, like, even just give me your best, like, Sunday school summary. What did you learn growing up in the church, growing up in Sunday school? Like, where are probably most people starting with their understanding of the book of Exodus?
I think through, like, Sunday school, what I remember, that, like, Moses is that one of those first characters of, like, God is going to use imperfect people. Mm-hmm. Like, God is going to use people who are even unwilling, like, mm-hmm. that his plans and purposes are going to prevail. And that God is going to speak to his people through crazy and awesome ways. Mm. I think that's really, like, what, you know, sticks out as I think of what do I just initially remember from Exodus.
Yeah, I think when it talks about, like, you know how you hear, like, did you hear this in Bible school, Sunday school, whatever you want to say? I think what's cool is, like, reading as an adult, you see the more in detail and mm-hmm. things that they left out in Sunday yeah, school. Sure. I think it's so cool because I'm like, oh, wow, no, they didn't tell me about this. But then you, like, dive deeper into it and you're just, like, mind blown at the Lord all over again. Like, as a kid, you're mind blown. But then, like, you read in even more detail and it's like, oh, my gosh, I am way more blindfolded. Like, mm-hmm. the Lord is so good. And mm-hmm. something that stands out to me in Exodus just in general is the deliverance. When you see the Lord, like, you see one word that comes to my mind when I think of Jesus in Exodus, the book of the Bible, is just, like, deliverance. Mm-hmm. I think of he's a promise keeper and he's a deliverer. That's really Those are good. The two things that really pop into my mind.
That's super good. I mean, that's seeing it from a very gospel-centered standpoint of understanding Exodus in light of the gospel. When you say promise keeper, what are you referring to?
I think of, trying to think back to all the things. It's just like the Lord promised that, like, he would deliver his people out of the land, that out of the wilderness, mm-hmm. but that they wouldn't see it. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, he kept his promise. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, they were delivered,
yep.
but after Moses
right.
passed. So I think that's really cool.
Yeah, and that's towards the end of Exodus. Yeah. But even before that, what I was pressing on was, like, that God had already made a promise.
Yeah.
Like, he had promised that he would form a people unto mm-hmm. himself, mm-hmm. that he would deliver people from the bondage of sin.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see in the early stages of Genesis, all the way back to Genesis chapter 11, we see that people are so under the grip of sin. That's where we see the Tower of Babel scene.
Mm-hmm.
But then God, in Abraham chapter 12. In Genesis chapter 12, he calls Abraham from the nations. And it's that now we start the tracking of the genealogy from Abraham all the way to what we get to eventually is Jesus. But in Genesis chapter 12, that's the beginning of the promise that God is going to deliver people that believe God and it was counted to them as righteousness. And Moses is in that lineage. And so, but before that, what we see is that humanity is under such a severe grip of sin that God is promising that he will deliver them despite their unwillingness and despite their ability to live up to the promises or live up to the covenants. And so that's where we find ourselves in Exodus is God has made a promise that he will deliver his people from sin. And so that's when I look at this, like in chapters, 1 through 11, one of the things, that I have sort of three sort of major points in thinking about Exodus 1 through 11. One of those is God leads us from false freedom to true freedom by making us uncomfortable. Us being uncomfortable on behalf of the Lord is one of the ways that he leads us from a false sense of security and freedom to where true freedom actually lives. And we know this from Exodus, where even after they're brought out of slavery in Egypt, the conditions of the wilderness are difficult. And they're like, could we just go back to all of the great provision that we had in Egypt? They were counting on a false sense of freedom, and they couldn't believe God for the true sense of freedom that he was leading them to. They couldn't bear being uncomfortable for a period of time until they got to true freedom. So that's going to be one of the things that we see in the book of Exodus. What else, Russ, Q, anything else? What were some of the Sunday school understandings of Exodus or some things you just kind of heard growing up around in and around church maybe?
I think Jess touched on a little bit, but as you get older and you begin to really dive in and read in between the lines, you do begin to see how involved, I don't know if involved is the right word I'm looking for, but just how much God was at work. Whereas sometimes as a kid, as a Sunday school, it's all about Moses or it's all about Pharaoh or it's all about the story. And so sometimes, and I mean, some of that is too, you're a kid, you don't necessarily understand everything, but some of that you just, you forget that like this is also a story about how God used these people and how God worked in the in-between and in the minute details. And sometimes I feel like we miss that because of the big Sunday school stories. You forget that like it was God at work, but he was working through Moses.
Right. Michael Heiser has this saying. He's just a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant scholar that has done a lot to make a lot of the things that don't make sense in the Bible make sense. And he said the things that stand out as odd, that don't fit, are some of the most important points to communicate what God is up to. And we're going to see one of those passages in Exodus chapter 4 where it's like, what in the world? It's just such an odd, I mean, for all you know, I mean, so for even us standing in the hallway talking about it before the podcast, that's why we were giggling when we got on here, is like, it is such a weird passage. But the weirdness of it is communicating to the reader something. And what I love about the Bible is it always stands up to that test of scrutiny.
That's right.
And so we'll dig into that a little bit. But what I would say kind of on to Russ's point, I think Sunday school does a good job of giving you sort of a baseline metaphorical understanding of the text. What I think we hope to get in Connect Group as we begin to study the Bible as adults that love Jesus, what we're on is a study towards the theological understanding of the text. That using the Bible as a study of God, right? Not just a study of lessons or stories to learn the general principles of the general content of the Bible, but how are we being wrapped up in this overall story of who God is and what he's like? That's more of a theological understanding of the Bible that I think that's what we're on a journey to, of how does this text help me understand who God is and what he's like? So Anything else on that or any other thoughts? Okay, so chapter 1, it begins to get into this decline in conditions for Israel. It says, a new king who, this is chapter 1, verse 8, a new king who had not known Joseph came to power in Egypt. He said to his people, look, the Israelite people are more numerous and powerful than we are. Let us deal shrewdly. Some of your translations may say, let us deal harshly with them. Otherwise, they will multiply further, and if war breaks out, they may join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. This is a very hard societal pivot compared to the end of Genesis. In the end of Genesis, you're like, man, this is a super harmonious relationship to where like God had provided safety and provision and resources for his people by leading them to Egypt. And now the hardness of the heart of this new Pharaoh, that's going to be an important point coming up in, with the plagues, has led them to these are unjust laws. This is an unjust enslavement of people. And it is something that God begins to work in the life of Moses to deliver them. So we have this decline in conditions, but what I would say is what this is the preparation for the promise. Mm-hmm. God is preparing through the suffering. So again, trying to hold two things in tension, like it is not God causing the suffering, it is God redeeming the suffering. Mm-hmm. And how he redeems the suffering is he eventually leads them into the Exodus and prepares them for the giving. It's the giving of the law that comes at Mount Sinai. It's not about them receiving the Ten Commandments so that they can now keep all these rules. It's that God delivers. Mm. And God delivers them from from slavery and from harsh conditions. Chapters 2 through 6 establishes Moses as this deliverer. So we have the birth of Moses. What's happening is that this king puts into effect this law that all Hebrew-born children or all the Hebrew-born children.
Hebrew boys.
All the boys are to be drowned in the Nile. But it says that some of the midwives intervene and they save as many of the children as they can. But then we have the birth of Moses in a weird, you could call it a coincidence, or you could see that this is God's hand at work, that it's actually Pharaoh's daughter who rescues this baby named Moses from the Nile. Everything you could possibly imagine, the Nile being dangerous, the Nile being full of crocodiles, the Nile being full of uncertainty. I mean, just imagine your newborn baby playing in a river. I don't care if it's the Ohupi. It's still going to be like, I don't want my newborn baby playing in a river, right? But twist of fate, Pharaoh's daughter rescues Moses and is adopted into Pharaoh's family. Irony upon irony, right?
I have a question with that.
Okay.
So in 2:7, it says, then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you? Yes, go, she answered. So the girl went and got the baby's mother. Mm-hmm. So he, like, ironically, even more, that is correct in the way it's written, in that she went and got Moses's mom, correct, who just put him in the Nile to nurse him.
Yep.
Did she know that that was Moses's mom? Mm.
It's a good question. I don't know. The text doesn't seem to indicate. I'm assuming, given that there was a plot for mass murder of Hebrew children, they would have been like able to be aware of, okay, this lady was pregnant. She has the capability of nursing, mm-hmm, and she doesn't have a baby.
Yeah.
So it's like, hey, you got some time on your hands. Why don't you come nurse this baby that we found?
One thing I think that's really cool with that, too, is it says in 10, when the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. Mm-hmm. And I see a cool metaphor. We talk a lot in the church about like baby dedications, but Moses' mom being willing to say, like, I'm giving up my son. And we see it on this side of the text of like what took place in her doing that. I'm not really, it doesn't necessarily say that she knew, you know, what was going to happen, but that she
just knew that he was a fine child.
It's just, like, it's a cool thing for me to read and just go, like, man, because of her obedience in that, like, look what happened.
Well, and I'm sure on the one hand, there's some like basic, like, for my son to live, his best opportunity is to stay alive in Pharaoh's house, mm-hmm. right? Like the quote unquote mother that's adopted him. Like, so in a lot of ways, this is the language that some of the other connection churches use that I really enjoy is like, in a lot of ways, this is a parent commissioning.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Moses is being commissioned that's into right. his purpose, and his mother doesn't know what it is,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but she has had the joy. Like, she had the joy, then the terror, then the miraculous joy
mm-hmm.
of raising Moses.
Yeah.
Or raising this
that's
son.
Incredible.
And now she commissions him, and she doesn't know what his purpose is going to be. She doesn't know what's going to come of his life.
Mm-hmm.
She just knows that she has a limited amount of time to prepare him to commission him into a dangerous world.
Don't we all?
Yeah.
It's just crazy.
Don't make me start crying about
this. It's just crazy, like, to think about all the stuff that's not, like, explained in the Bible. Mm-hmm. Like, did she tell him, like, hey, I'm your mom, by the way?
Yeah.
like, you know, like, it's just to think about how long did they have together? What would that look like? But it's just really cool. I don't know.
Samuel has a similar story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, or in Samuel, like, his mom prays and prays and prays and prays and prays that God would give her a son. But as she gives birth to a son, God answers the prayer. She still has to hand this child back over to service in the tabernacle,
mm-hmm.
right? Like of like the to be a minister to God, and she has to hand that back in a way that's like what it represents is like the child is first and foremost a child to God
mm-hmm.
Before they are a child to us, and that's mm-hmm. a really hard thing for me to live in light of is that my children
mm-hmm.
first and foremost are children to Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
Second, they are a child to me that I steward God's children.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, you can't really disassociate, but I don't think God intends for us to, right? That, like, I love them as deeply and as strongly and as powerfully as I can and know that that's not even a 1/1,000th of how much God loves my kids
mm-hmm.
and God loves your kids and your kids. But it's like a reminder, right? It's like
yeah.
a reminder to us of the exponential love of God for all people. But it's hard for us to have the same type of love for, you know, unspecified face on the other side of the planet, but our children
mm-hmm.
bring that to the forefront.
You said you hit on this a minute ago too, but I don't know that you hit that we went extremely deep on it, but the fact that Pharaoh told them to throw the baby boys in the Nile and that Moses was in fact put in the Nile, he was put in a basket instead of just thrown there to drown, but then how much that plan of like throw him in the Nile backfired on him and going back to like what you said about Joseph, what he meant for evil, God turned for good.
Yeah. 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 There's always sort of these like two different ways to look at these scenes where we see like the unjust or the evil or the nonsensical. And a lot of times people read that into the character of God, where we see these moments where God is constantly redeeming.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see it in the moment, but we see it looking back. We see it in the rearview mirror. We don't see it in the windshield.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of God's redemption happening in people's lives. So, yeah, for sure. All right, so chapters... next we have the scene where Moses, like, intervenes between an Egyptian that is, I guess, beating up on an Israelite. Moses kills the dude. Buries him in the sand. Then he intervenes between two Israelites that are fighting one another, and they're like, are you going to murder one of us too? So he flees to Midian. One thing, I think this is a helpful thing, kind of brings clarity. Midian would have been a community of Hebrew people. That's one thing I didn't understand until I dug a little bit deeper and listened to some other teaching on this. That this would have been Moses as a descendant of Abraham returning to his native people.
Mm.
So instead of living in Egyptian culture in Pharaoh's house in Midian, when he goes to be with Jethro and marries Zipporah, he as an Egyptian raised, you know, royal member of the royal family of Egyptian culture, is now being transferred into the nomadic shepherd culture of the Hebrew people. Mm. And so that's going to come up as important here in a minute. But we have that in two. And in that context, while shepherding his father-in-law, Jethro's, who is the priest of Midian, right? So the priest of Midian, the priest to Yahweh of Midian, probably like we would think of an elder. Mm-hmm. So he's a business owner, a farmer, an old school word. He is a sheep husbandryman. Mm. Yeah. It's what we call ranchers. And sheep, so
husbandryman.
Yep. Mm. Cow husbandry is
is that farmersonly.com?
Of course Q would say something like that.
Farmers only. You take over. You explain
it's where
it
you get your sheep husbandry and your cow husbandry.
But don't
you don't have to be lonely.
At Farmers Only. Yep.
All right, back
if you're wanted for murder and single, Midiansonly.com.
Yeah.
Right there. So all right. all right. So we have the burning bush scene, which is very like this is Yahweh communicating with Moses in an extremely personal way. This is where we get one of the first explanations of what does the word Yahweh mean? Who is the distinct Hebrew God? Is I am who I am, mm-hmm. or I am who I will always be. That's God's communication of the exclusivity that he is the one true God. Mm-hmm. So this is important because this is who Jesus is referring to when he refers to the Father. He's referring to Yahweh, the I am who I always will be. And he says, I and the Father are one. So that's where, for us as Christians, that we bring our full Trinitarian theology to bear. But in God establishing a people to himself, this is how he's communicating here in the burning bush scene. And so we have this establishment of Moses as this deliverer, as this one who will I love the way you used that phrase earlier, Jess, of deliverance. Mm-hmm. Moses is the person that God begins to work in their life, calling them. We've gone through this with the Experience in God study, right, where God is seemingly at work and has a desire to deliver the people of the descendants of Israel. But he works through Moses to bring about this deliverance. Mm. And so God, what I would say at Connection Church, has a desire to disciple all the people that attend here. Mm-hmm. But he is going to work through current disciples to disciple other people. And so this is one of those connections. Now, what we see is that if this would be... So let's do this. Let's just jump into this. This is... Exodus chapter 4, let's just jump straight to the confusing part. Chapter 4, verse 24. On the trip at an overnight campsite, it happened that the Lord confronted him and sought to put him to death. So Zipporah took a flint, cut off her son's foreskin, and threw it at Moses' feet. Then she said, "You are a bridegroom of blood to me." So he let him alone. At that time, she said, "You are a bridegroom of blood," referring to the circumcision. All right, give me your best explanation of that passage.
You want me to go?
Whoever.
Okay.
Whoever.
Got questions told me that pretty much God wanted to kill Moses, or felt that Moses was deserving of some punishment, because in Genesis, he gives him this new covenant to follow and tells him that he is to circumcise his people. But Moses apparently does not circumcise his son and so is disobedient. And so God is saying, "You're being disobedient. I guess I'm going to kill you." And then Zipporah, I don't know how she knows about this, but she goes in and circumcises her son and throws it at seemingly Moses' feet.
Okay.
But I think Jordan's got something else for us here.
Well, but I think that's really, really close. Go ahead, Russ.
What I was going to say to even add to what Q was saying is that Moses is about to go back into Egypt to be the deliverer, be the tool that God uses to deliver his people, which are going to be separated from the oppressors and the oppressors and the oppressed, and are going to be the circumcised and uncircumcised. But Moses has not even made that own distinction within his own family. Mm. And so I think that's a big deal of he's about to go to rescue the circumcised out of Egypt, but he hasn't even done that for his own son, a part of his family.
Exactly. That's a good point. Jess, anything?
Yeah, I was just looking at my commentary, and that's exactly what it says. It said, but Moses could not effectively serve as a deliverer of God's people until he had fulfilled the conditions of God's covenant. And one of those conditions was circumcision. So just to add on to that, like in order to be that deliverer, he had to act in that. And so now that you understand it all, it makes sense as to why the Lord's like, I'm going to kill you because you didn't follow my commands just in the beginning.
Yeah, and so it's what it sounds like, though, and even in the way that we're describing it, is, and truthfully, I completely disagree with the way the HCSB translates this. The what it makes it sound like, it even, it so in English, we have to add punctuation, and we have to make choices about interpretation of the Hebrew, right? What this, the way that they punctuate and the way that they emphasize certain points within the English, it sounds very different than the Hebrew, which, you know, if you want to get out of any biblical problem, just say, well, that's not what it says in the original language. But that's not what I'm trying to do. I've tried to really dig into and find some of the research on this. So let's back up. Moses at the burning bush, God calls him. Think about this in your own life, right? Like, God makes crystal clear what he is calling Moses to do. And what does Moses do?
Makes excuses.
He makes excuses. It's like, God, I got this speech problem. And God's like, no, no, no. I am who I will always be is going with you, though. The one true God. I will be with you. He's like, oh, God, send someone else. I don't want to. Moses is literally whining at the manifest presence of God and the call that he's placed on his life. And so God even then makes a concession. Okay, so this, there's also a geography issue at play here. Where is Moses when he's at the burning bush?
He's out tending the flock.
Out tending the flock, but they were on the where? It says the backside of the wilderness. I mean, being in the wilderness is one thing. Being on the backside of the wilderness, you out there, right? So it says he's probably at Mount Sinai, more than likely. He's more, or sometimes even referred to as Mount Horeb. But the promise he says is you will come back and you'll worship at this mountain. But I'll tell you where he's not. He's not at Midian. But he returned. So he's called then to go to Egypt. And he's like, God, but I got this speech problem. He's like, no, 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 I'm going to go with you. He's like, no, send someone else. He's like, all right, I'll send you Aaron. Behold, your brother or stepbrother is on the way. Your brother-in-law, whoever he is, Aaron is on the way. He will be your mouthpiece. So God, in commissioning Moses, sends him the help that Moses perceives that he needs. Now what does Moses do? It seems that he drags his feet. So he drags his feet, goes back to his father-in-law's camp, Jethro, gets his wife, gets his kids, and is just kind of dawdling. And finally he gets underway, and like God's getting this thing going. He's like, come on, let's go. We're going to go deliver the people out of Egypt. And that's where we pick up in 4. So verse 18, then Moses went back to his father-in-law Jethro and said to him, please let me return to my relatives in Egypt and see if they are still living. Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. Now in Midian, the Lord told Moses, return to Egypt, for all the men who wanted to kill you are dead. So Moses took his wife and sons, put them on a donkey, and returned to the land of Egypt. And Moses took God's staff in his hand. So look, again, he's having to say, Let's go. Mm-hmm. Come on, let's get going. The Lord instructed Moses, when you go back to Egypt, make sure you do all the wonders before Pharaoh that I have put within your power, but I will harden his heart so that he won't let the people go. Then you will say to Pharaoh, this is what Yahweh says, Israel is my firstborn son. I told you, let my son go so that he may worship me, but you refused to let him go. Now I will kill your firstborn son. Then, in other words, God lays out the plagues that are to come. This, he's like, this is how this is basically going to go down. Some of this is just evidence that, yeah, God is with Moses. These are all this, all the encouragement that Moses needs. But on the way, this is what I think has happened in this passage of 24 through 26. Moses, as who is supposed, he's an uncircumcised leader going back to a circumcised people. And so the one who's supposed to be working this deliverance has bypassed and compromised on the on part of the covenant promises that he should have known. Jethro definitely knows. Zipporah definitely knows, right? Jethro is the priest of Midian, the priest of Yahweh to Midian. Zipporah is the daughter of the priest to Midian. And now she's married to Moses, who, this is what's interesting, is that the Egyptians also practiced circumcision. It was a different circumcision. So this was part of the some of the research that I did highlighted this, that, but it what would have been clear to Zipporah, because, you know, they're married, different circumcision. And now they've been together long enough that Zipporah knows that there's a difference, and now they've had a child, and they didn't. They also can, so it's not just that it was limited to Moses. The compromises of the covenant are now being passed on to his children. Mm-hmm. This is just, you know, big picture theology, biblical theology, you know, import for us today, theology 101. Like, the compromise of the leader passes down to the compromise of the people. Mm. And so that's, it's not a small thing. Like, Moses has made compromise, and the Lord has made plenty of concessions to meet Moses where he's at and given him grace upon grace upon grace upon grace until he's finally confronted. Now, Zipporah took the flint, so she knows. So this, if I were to play it out and retell this in sort of South Georgia, Jordan language, Zipporah understands the how God seemingly is confronting Moses, whether he had a fever along the way, whether he got sick, whether an angel of the Lord appeared to put Moses to death, whatever happens, Zipporah instinctively knows. And why would she do this? Like, Casey, the last time the boys got sick, did she grab a scalpel and just like, I know it'll help Trace right here, right? No. Like, no way, right? Like, but something for her, she knows because she knows. Mm-hmm. And she actually, so this is crazy, right? So she circumcises the son, and the blood of the foreskin she drags across Moses's privates. This is where it says, this is where I disagree with HCSB. It says, threw it at Moses' feet. Feet in Hebrew times in an ancient Near Eastern language is anything literally from your literal feet to your loins, to your groin. So instead of saying like your privates or your groin area or your junk or whatever, it's referred to as your feet. There are other biblical examples of this, and there's some in, and I don't want to, you know, dive too far into this. But if you look, and there's lots of places where there is, I mean, this is common for us, right? Where we use colloquial or idiomatic language to communicate, of saying, like, if I was to say, hey, do y'all want to go to eat? Yeah, where's that restaurant? It's over yonder. And I just pointed, like, who the heck knows where yonder is? Except you can see where my hand's pointing, right? Yeah. Or, you know, if we say across the tracks, or if you say, like, you know, whatever. Like, I could think of every example is one that I should not say into the microphone.
I was just waiting for you to say somehow. I'm like, what too. Like euphemism is he about to use?
No. Yeah. That's what it is. It's a common expression for, so, but here's why this makes sense, right? She circumcises the son as an atoning blood sacrifice for the sin of Moses, mm-hmm. for the compromise of Moses. And this is where Michael Heiser kind of draws this out. Why isn't Moses circumcised? Because the healing process of a grown man being circumcised, when God's ready to get this on the road mm-hmm. here to deliver Egypt, deliver the mm-hmm. people from Egypt, the healing process would have been a lot longer. Moses has already been twiddling his thumbs. Mm-hmm. And so, like, clearly, this is what I want to make clear. It is not plain that that's what the text says. Mm-hmm. We have to interpret the text on this point. I don't think it makes sense that God is randomly confronting Zipporah and Moses. I don't think it makes sense that Zipporah is just like, I know how to get us out of this situation. Let me circumcise my son and in a super disrespectful way mm-hmm. throw the bloody foreskin mm-hmm. at Moses' feet and like, you're a pathetic piece of crap bridegroom of blood. That's what mm-hmm. we import when we think about this passage is like Zipporah is like showing her husband up. Mm-hmm. More than likely, it's a sacrificial intercession by the daughter of the priest of Midian to know that this is an atoning work on behalf of Moses. They circumcised the son on behalf of the father.
Would Moses have had the circumcision of the Egyptians?
Correct. Still circumcised, different circumcision. And so this is... And so why does this matter? Fast forward, this is where I think there's theological continuity here. As the people are brought out of Egypt and they go into the promised land, or even as they're wandering in the wilderness and as they are marrying into the promised land, that is an undeniable evidence mm-hmm. of being a member of the covenant, so yeah. much so that the daughters are trained. Wedding night, if old buddy's not circumcised, you get out of that marriage. Mm. You do not consummate the marriage if there is not evidence of the covenant. Mm. And so for us in sort of a hypersexualized society, this sounds one like a huge waste of time, but then two, it sounds sort of freaky and weird. But for them it was about, no, we want to be a part of who the promised people of God are. And they took that seriously. So there's more that you could dive into there, but that's the consistency, right? It's like this is God is building into the beginning what he wants in the end, which mm-hmm. is a covenant people to himself. And circumcision is a part of that, which would have been different. They would have for sure 100% been different people going into the land. So that's what's at play there with that text. And so this is the one where I got Jess giggling real good. Here's another place where we see this feet language, Ruth and Boaz. So it says that Ruth goes to Boaz and uncovers his feet. Look, when I sleep at night, I like my feet out from under the cover as much as the next guy.
All right.
We're going to stop.
But that's not what's happening in that passage. If you think about it, though, again, what we bring with us is our American hypersexualized society. Mm-hmm. But for Ruth, this would have been the next step of covenant inheritance, instructed to her by a daughter who's already in the covenant, mm-hmm. which would have been Naomi. And Naomi is saying, daughter, you go to the person that's supposed to marry you into the covenant. He is the next kinsman redeemer in this line. While he's sleeping, go and uncover his feet, which would have been actually his junk, and just lay down. There would have been nothing sexual that happened. Mm-hmm. Boaz wouldn't have woken up and like rolled over and turned on some Luther Vandross.
Oh,
like there you go. he would have understood. She is asking for continuity in the covenant mm-hmm. because she wants to now be a part of the covenant people of God. That's why he wakes up and is very endearing. And he's like, it is very honorable what you're asking of me. Mm-hmm. And he walks through the covenant formalities. Actually, there's another kinsman redeemer. If he passes, then you will marry me. And so But when it says uncovered feet, it's privates. So,
Russ, you got to say what you said before we started. I don't want to steal your joke.
Puts a new twist on the Sunday service when John took his shoes off and showed everybody his feet.
John, you got to stop showing people your feet, man.
Like, you are at HR. Come on.
You wouldn't believe it. He's just showing his feet constantly at the office. Just
I've even seen Jordan uncovering his feet. Like, it's crazy.
Man, yeah. Welcome to Connection Staff.
Hey, let's go down this rabbit hole for a second while we're on the topic. And Jordan, if this is not where you want to spend the rest of the time, but for the world we live in today, especially for our Connect Group leaders, I feel like this question could possibly arise with our Connect Groups of what does that mean for us today, specifically males for circumcision?
What does that mean for us today?
Yeah, like what is, because we talk about the law and this and that, and just, I know that's a complete side topic, but it just kind of came to mind.
Well, we just, I mean, going through the book of Acts, right? Like, Paul goes through this whole ordeal of circumcision is no longer the sign of the covenant. Being sealed by the Holy Spirit is the sign of the covenant. Mm-hmm. And so that's the book of Acts. If you guys want to go back and dig through that, like, there's a whole, I mean, that's the Jerusalem Council, right? Like, you don't have to be saved and then become Jewish. Mm-hmm. You are saved and you're sealed by the Holy Spirit, and Christ redeems all culture. He doesn't force us to conform back to a Jewish culture. So that would be my 30-second answer on that.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. So all you adult male men out there, you don't have to uncover your feet and get circumcised now for to receive the Holy Spirit. So, all right. So that gets us through Exodus chapter 4, and then now it seems Moses is ready. He meets up with Aaron. He goes and confronts Moses. That's chapters 5. Sorry, he goes and confronts Pharaoh. and then chapter 6, God promises freedom to as his work of delivering the people through Moses. Gives a recap of the genealogy of Moses and Aaron. And then in chapter 7, we pick up with the beginning of the plagues. And so this is the kind of the main thing that I wanted to sometimes I have heard it taught, and I've heard it talked about as if this is some type of, like, you know, that this is part of the point of this is that each plague represents some type of confrontation mm-hmm. with some Egyptian god. So I kind of looked into that and dug into that. And so we have these different plagues of the Nile turning into blood, the frogs, the gnats, the this commentary is Hapi, Heket, Kepri, Apis, Sekhmet, or Amun-Ra, not the wide receiver for the Lions, but the
Makes
god
on fantasy.
All Nut, right. Sinaham, again, Amun-Ra, and then Pharaoh himself or Osiris for the firstborn. I would say that God confronts false idol worship in all places at all times. That's what it means to believe in the one true God. But this is sort of the conclusion of this one commentary. But we must be clear that Exodus does not concern itself with a polemic or an argumentation against any specific Egyptian god. The preacher or teacher of Exodus should avoid this mode of interpretation both because it is not the point of the biblical story and because it has no meaning for the modern audience. I think that's important. That's not what the text itself seems to be trying to do, according to this commentator. But it's certainly true that for each of those Egyptian gods, it doesn't have a direct import for us today. Mm-hmm. Now, you could argue this commentator or against this commentator's point by saying, well, of course, like God is constantly in the business of confronting the idols that we mm-hmm. create, the idols of consumerism, the idols mm-hmm. of the American dream, the idol of health and wellness, and so on and so forth, nationalism, etc. But I would say in general, this lends into a mode of interpretation called allegorizing the text, of trying to read allegory into, in other words, the text says one thing, but is trying to create meaning in another way. I think Jess's point is actually the correct one, which is this is about deliverance. Mm-hmm. This is a promise-keeping God delivering his people. Mm-hmm. And I think this most specific thing that we see God comes against is not so much all of these little g Egyptian gods. He's coming against the hardness of Pharaoh's heart. Mm-hmm. And that's what seems to be the main point in Exodus 7 through 11 is what, and Russ, I'm going to tee you up on this because you just talked about it Sunday, but what does the Bible talk about when it comes to people hardening their heart versus God hardening their heart?
Yeah, so I think about, and even specifically in here, there's a switch of, after each one of these plagues, Pharaoh hardening his own heart to the point where then it changes to God hardening mm-hmm. his heart. And so I think the more we reject God, the more we're disobedient, the more we disregard his plans or his commands, then we're making a choice to follow our own sin. And I even talked about it yesterday in the sermon, but in Romans 1, it talks about that God gives us over to our desires. So at some point, the more we continue to harden our heart by rejecting God and choosing our own sin, he's going to say, you know what, here you go. Have it your way. And so I think we see that in this too. I believe it's in, I think it's in 9, after one of the plague of boils is the first time that the text no longer says Pharaoh hardened his heart, but it says the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. And so we see this switch of where God's saying, this is how you want it, this is how you're going to get it.
Yeah. I think in general it points to idolatry always creates spiritual sickness.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you talked about that a little bit on Sunday too, of like there is a price to pay when it comes to being in a spiritually toxic and a spiritually sick environment, like the polytheism that came with this Egyptian culture, which should point to us of why it was necessary for God to deliver his people out of Egypt. That's an important part of it, because sin hardens our heart, and our hardened hearts choose sin, and sin hardens our heart, and then our hardened hearts choose sin. And so that seems to be the rhythm at play there with that, and that points to why God was delivering his people. But what's also clear is that God continuously gives Pharaoh opportunity. He consistently gives Pharaoh more and more and more opportunity to turn, which he also does with Moses, right? So we see both with the people of God and those outside of the people of God, God is consistently extending grace and opportunities to repent.
And patience.
Yep. All right, so two things. Anything else on the... Avoid allegorizing these plagues. Like, I mean, where I kind of land is that, sure, these are extraordinary, miraculous events that occur that are describing events, not prescribing that these are things that we should seek out or even plan on seeing again, or but they're just describing events, miraculous events for a specific purpose to establish a new covenant people of God. And not new covenant in the sense of Christ, but it's certainly walking in that direction. So a few things. Like I said, one thing I want you to see in Exodus 1 through 11, God leads us from false freedom to true freedom by making us uncomfortable. We certainly see the people of God had to grow even more uncomfortable. They were already in a bad situation, being oppressed in their slavery, but they get more uncomfortable before they get free. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I've counseled, like there was a college student I was talking to the other day, and she was just... one, sick over her own sin, but then two, like, why are people benefiting from my walk with the Lord, but I don't feel like I'm benefiting from my walk with the Lord? And my encouragement to her was kind of on this point, like, I've always found that God is making me so uncomfortable with where I'm at before he's walking me into something new. And so there's some other freedom on the other side of this discomfort. And so I think that's one thing we see here happening. Number two, peace and purpose are found in participating in what God's doing, even if it disrupts what we are currently doing. Some of this is coming from the experience in God material, but again, peace and purpose are found in participating in what God's already doing. God set out to deliver the people from oppression and slavery. Moses was invited to be a part of that. And so he had to stop his animal husbandry in Midian in order to join in with what God was doing. And it was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And it pushed him outside of what he was capable of doing. But he got to join in with something miraculous. But God was already doing it. God was already at work. Number three, God delivers his people by grace, then forms them into his image. It's very important. Very, very important. The law doesn't come until chapter 20. I'm picking up a lot of Tim Keller stuff here, that God was setting out to deliver his people, not giving them the law and seeing who passes and who fails.
Yeah.
His deliverance was a unilateral work of grace. His grace delivered them out of slavery and bondage and into freedom. And then he went through the process of forming them into his people. That's what happens before the law, during the giving of the law, and then after the law. And to Russ's point on Sunday, Moses doesn't even get to come down the mountain before they are building an idol, despite their deliverance.
Yeah.
And God still works and forms them and continues what you could say is to press Egypt out of the people as he is pressing them into the promised land. But God delivers his people by grace and then forms them into his image. The law reveals the character of God, not the rules to be accepted. So this is a God of order, a God of structure, a God of being personal, but he's completely holy. And that's what the law is going to remind us of when we get into the rest of the book of Exodus.
When are you preaching a sermon on this?
Oh, I don't know. God doesn't just give them the law. He gives them deliverance. This is, again, all ripped from Tim Keller, right? But this was mind-blowing for me. What we typically think of, oh, what happens in Exodus? Oh, God sets his people free and he gives them the law. That's close, but actually the emphasis is on God delivers.
Yeah.
He delivers the people. Then he gives them the law, but then he gives them two more gifts, which is what we'll get into in the rest of the podcast. He delivers them, he gives them the law, then he gives them his presence in the tabernacle. Pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. He gives them the tabernacle to where Moses can go and they can see Moses meeting with God personally. He gives them his personal presence. And then he gives them the sacrifices. It's like, hey, here's the law. Here's my presence. I know you're not going to fulfill the law. Here's the sacrifices to reconcile you back when you fail. Grace upon grace upon grace upon grace. In other words, he knows our weaknesses. He knows our weaknesses. Exodus shouldn't communicate a standard that you and I could never live up to as our hope. It should communicate standards and a deliverance that you and I can't live up to, and God already knew that.
Yeah, I said something about that on Sunday, too, and for those of y'all that didn't hear it, but I began reading in Genesis at the first of the year, and I think for a lot of my life, I looked at Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and all these books of like the harshness and the law and all these things. But this time around reading it, it felt like I saw what you're talking about. I saw for the first time just an immense amount of grace that God has had for us through reading, you know, those Old Testament books. And it's been pretty fascinating to see it through that lens.
I think it's also so cool because, like, just keeping it modern day, too, like, I see me in Moses. I see me, like, my stubbornness, and I see, like, my excuses, and, like, I'm in Judges right now, and something that I'm learning is, like, the Lord uses those who are submissive. If you are willing to be submissive, like, that's what he's asking for, submissiveness, and just, like, seeing how, like, he uses these judges that are sinners just like us. They're imperfect people just like us, but like He uses them for his glory. And I thought, like, in the beginning I was going to say this, but yesterday it was so funny that it wasn't funny, but it was, because you were in here and you were like so nervous and you're like, how do you do this? You were like, you were just like, oh my gosh, like, I'm just so nervous right now. And I think it's so funny because in your weakness, the Lord gave you strength and he used you as a vessel and he brought the word through you. And so I just think of scripture of where he says, like, when I'm weak, you are strong. Or when you are weak, I am strong.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I just think of, like, when you are just submissive to the Lord, like, he will use you for his glory. That's why we're all where we are as Connect Group leaders, is like, we said yes to the Lord. No matter, like, we can come up with excuses all that we want, but the Lord will use us when we say, when we give him one yes, you know?
When you preaching on a sermon.
Now I say that'll preach right there.
Never. We're not a Connect. Not a
Got to keep y'all in line. My goodness. Talk about golden calf.
Jeez,
I can't laugh while I'm sorry.
Quentin, thanks for all your contributions to today's podcast. We will see you next time on Equipped.